So before we start the program part of this morning, I would invite you to turn to your neighbor and say very briefly, like in a word or two, what your very first paid outside of the house.
Brief thought in mind of what your first job was.
I've invited two of your fellow Christians to come up this morning and reflect on their first jobs. And one of the ways we have diversity in this congregation is across generations. So you're going to see me wanting to do a lot of that. So I asked somebody to come forth and tell me the first paid work they had, if that job was with the last 5 years. And then the second one, what their first job was, if that first job was within the last 30 years. So is Leo here? Leo Phillips Schmidt? Yeah, so Leo's going to start, and then Eric Scott. So first Leo, and then Eric. So thank you very much for being to your house.
Hello. Work is an interesting thing for me to talk about, because I was your average fresh out of high school 18-year-old with little motivation and lazy tendencies. However, with work comes the dreaded idea of responsibility. Who would wash the dishes if I wasn't there? Who would stock the front line with dishes if I wasn't there? Who would dare clean queso off of huge cracked plastic tubs? Most importantly, though, who would take a 20-minute bathroom break during their rush hour? I guess what I'm trying to say is that I'm expected to do many menial things in my day-to-day work, and that expectation gave me just enough of a wake-up call to literally wake up at 9 in the morning. When I was informed by my mother, no, directed by my mother, that the fellowship would be asking me to stand up here and deliver a speech about my work, the only thought going on in my head was, oh great, now I gotta wake up at 9 again. Working as a dishwasher is something I'm actually very happy to be doing. I get paid to spray hot water on ceramics, and sometimes, as an added bonus in my profession, I get to eat half of the taco. It can be dirty, exhausting, and will always, without fail, soak my clothes, but at least I'm getting more than minimum wage. Yeah. Lastly, dishwashing isn't exactly a gateway to becoming my planned profession as a firefighter. However, it does share a startling number of similarities. At my work as a dishwasher, I lift heavy objects in sweltering, time-sensitive situations. I utilize protective gear to ensure my safety, and more often than not, I end the day with burn marks and blisters. Any training firefighter out there should take some advice from me and work a few months as a dishwasher. After all, the pay is better.
So, I've been asked to speak about my first job in celebration of Labor Day, also marking the unofficial end of summer. As it just so happens, my first job coincides with another holiday, Memorial Day, marking the unofficial beginning of summer. On May 4th, 1985, I turned 16, which meant I could get my work papers and forge my way into the land of the employed and make my own money. Nevertheless, my first paying job was an inauspicious one. It was only part-time, and it would only last a month. Additionally, I owe my first job to two things: nepotism and death. That may seem strange to some, but my first job was doing lawn maintenance and groundskeeping work at Cold Spring Cemetery. It was located about a half a mile from the home of my great-grandparents. In fact, because my great-grandfather was the treasurer of the cemetery, I essentially was guaranteed the job. My duties consisted of handling all the areas of the cemetery where the riding mowers could not go. I was tasked with taking a push mower and cutting the grass of every large hill and around gravestones. On occasion, occasion, I would have to use the weed whacker and go around gravestones in the older, more forgotten sections of the cemetery. It was long, hot, hard, back-breaking work. I was 16. So every day after school, I would come home, change my clothes, and ride my bike to Cold Springs. I would work until 6 or 7 at night. Additionally, I would work on Saturdays from 8 until 12. I did this all in the preparation of preparing the grounds for Memorial Day weekend. I did this all for the meager sum of $3.35 an hour, the federal minimum wage of 1985. One of the things I remember most was this unusually long and steep hill. It was extremely troublesome in that there wasn't any really good way to figure out how to mow it. I could mow it lengthwise, but then the gas would start to spill out of the mower. But if I tried to push the mower down the hill, I could slip and fall and cut my toe off. So it was one of those things. But what I learned in that process was that work is hard. No matter what it is that you do, whether it's a push mower, or whether it's sitting behind a desk, or whether it's standing in front of a group of students, work is something that you do, and you should find joy in it, because if you don't find joy in it, why are you doing it?
How many of you have stories like that? We all have to have stories. It'd be a cool anthology, like Auburn UU Fellowship work stories. So I can tell my work story for a minute. Like many girls, my first paid job outside of the home that is beyond my 50 cents a week allowance was babysitting. At 12 and 13, I had a fair-sized clientele of families in the suburban subdivisions within 15 minutes bike ride of our house. Now, some of our employers were great with babies that actually slept, toddlers who didn't have tantrums, and refrigerators that were supplied with Dove bars and soda. And they paid me, when I finished working, 75 cents an hour, even a dollar. Now, other jobs involve babies with constant diaper rashes and colic, four-year-old bullies, and picky eaters. Now, I remember Jeremy. Jeremy's mother was a piano teacher, so I took care of Jeremy when she was giving lesson. Jeremy only ate oatmeal with two scoops of milk chocolate chips and two things of whipped cream. And if you did not do that, out of the high chair. And for her, promises of tomorrow, I will get you what I owe you. But it was mostly okay work, and the coins and the bills I collected were put in an envelope in my dresser drawer, and I saved them up for special things, extra special things, like my very first, and this will really date me, pink transistor radio. The one I listened to when the Giants lost the baseball playoff series to the Dodgers, and my heart was broken. And then there was my first purple miniskirt that my mother made me take back to the shopping center. And then a Samoyed puppy that cost $75 and took months of earnings, much to my parents' horror, when I brought her home, since of course I didn't figure on having to feed or inoculate or spay her. Whatever I earned and whatever I saved and whatever I spent this money on didn't in any way have to go for basics, because I was fed and I was clothed and I was housed and I was even taken out for movies and hamburgers with or without my wages. Work enhanced my sense of being responsible and capable. It brought me metaphorically a feeling of independence. It certainly filled up some otherwise dull and endless summers. I bet none of you have had dull and endless summers. It was good, in short, for what we like to call in Unitarian Universalism, character development.
I didn't do it for bread. In other words, I did it for the roses, for enrichment, for my soul. Now, I can't say the same for the first job I landed after graduating with high honors in journalism from the University of California at Berkeley in 1970, the year of one of our periodic great recessions, when no one, it seemed, was hiring. Armed with my prestigious degree, oh, by the way, Berkeley just got named the number one public university for undergraduate education in the world. So picture me being pretty arrogant in 1970, going out for a job. Armed with my prestigious degree, I went to work for Swenson's Ice Cream Parlor, serving up single scoop and double scoop cones filled with apple pie, pistachio, marble fudge, and mocha ice cream. After the first couple of days of enjoying the free taste we snuck when traffic was slow, I stopped craving ice cream entirely for 30 years. My arm ached and my hand burned from dipping down to the bottom of cartons. I tired of having people bark orders at me and change their minds about which flavor they wanted, or not have the right change and expect me to make up for it at the end of my shift. But my then husband and I needed the money that I brought in with no benefits and no holiday pay, certainly no sense of dignity, and really, really no way to stretch or to bloom. I didn't last all that long as an ice cream scooper, not even as long as my ex-husband, who had dropped out of college to find himself, lasted on the line at the Del Monte canning plant, or in his next job working swing shift in the collections department of an upscale department store. I remember that it was not so much that we ate a lot of fatty ground beef and soups made from turkey necks and bulk carrots, or that we lived in a third floor walk-up apartment where the heat only came on a few hours a day that bothered, even depressed me. It was the way I was treated in the charity medical clinic at Mount Zion Hospital. The forms that we had to fill to get food stamps to supplement the less than living wages that we were earning, and the look in the eyes of fellow shoppers when I actually used them, checking out, of course, what I put in my cart, looking for the waste and the indulgence. Oh my God, I miss my dignity. I miss my sense of being special and worthy. I miss believing that there were endless possibilities. This period of genteel poverty was relatively short-lived, and the truth is, while our parents wanted us to make our own way as a headstrong young couple, they didn't think to get married, let alone have children, they never would have let us go without electricity or end up on the streets. We had a safety net in the form of economically stable extended families who would only let us dip down so far before they helped us back up for our sakes, and certainly for the sake of their grandchildren. And we were embedded in a culture where the assumption was that we would do better sooner or later. My young woman's dream of a better vocation of bread and roses in my work, in my life, was only for me a dream deferred, not as soon as I wished, not a dream that died, or no dreams at all. Well, that was not so for my grandfather, and I would wager many of our parents and grandparents. A few years after the turn of the 20th century, my grandfather on my father's side escaped involuntary permanent conscription in the Tsar's army as a teenager and made his own way at age 13 to Boston, where he went to work doing what his father had done, his grandfather had done, and his great-grandfather had done. Son of a tailor, he found a job in a ladies' coat-making factory where the hours were long, the pay was ludicrous, and the conditions substandard. The same sort of conditions, I imagine, as existed in the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory in New York in 1911,
when more than 100 shirtwaist workers, many of them young female immigrant workers, either died in the fire that broke out on the 8th floor of the factory or jumped to their deaths. Many of these workers were unable to escape because the doors had been locked to prevent them from stealing or taking unauthorized bathroom breaks. My grandfather joined the International Ladies Garment Workers Union. In fact, he founded the Ladies International Garment Workers Union in Boston. My grandfather, so I am a union maid. I don't believe he expected intrinsic rewards for his hours of sewing and later supervising seamstresses. He wanted fair pay. He wanted safety. He wanted bread, in other words. But he had no expectations of roses. I know that from reading some of his scribblings, translated recently from Yiddish to English, that my grandfather had a gift for storytelling. But whether he ever dreamed of a vacation in writing, whether he ever dreamed at all of possibilities beyond his work life, beyond manufacturing ladies' coats and providing for his family, no one seems to know. All I know is that the story is that as they got deeper and deeper into the Depression, my grandfather got deeper and deeper into schnapps at the end of the day. That and eating Chinese food every Friday in Chinatown in Boston. And my grandmother, who was a peasant woman from Russia, she would look at all the dishes, you know, that go around on the Lady Susan. She would take all the dishes, put them into a central bowl, stir it up, and serve her family Chinese stew every Friday night in Boston during the Depression. The song we sang earlier in the service, and thank you for doing it, it's a challenging one, Bread and Roses, was first heard during a strike in Lawrence, Massachusetts during January and March 1912. Earlier that same year, the Massachusetts legislature finally passed a law limiting the working hours of children under 18 to 54 hours a week. The huge textile corporations vehemently opposed the law, and an act of retaliation cut the working hours and thus the wages of all their employees, adults and children, leading to a total walkout of workers in the Lawrence factories, more than 35,000 of them. The textile mill strike, which united dozens of immigrant communities under the Garment Workers Union, was led by a large extent, we are told, by the women. Some have said that during the strike, there were women who carried a sign that said, "We want bread, but roses too." In the course of the strike, the workers presented their bosses with these demands. And listen to see if you think these were reasonable. A 15% wage increase, double pay for overtime, no discrimination against strikers, an end to speed up expectations when they were required to speed up faster and faster and faster, and an end, and this will be very ironic today, an end to discrimination against foreign-born workers. It was, according to labor organizer Bill Haywood, a wonderful strike, a significant strike, the greatest strike that's ever been carried out in this country. This was a strike that appealed both for fair wages and dignified conditions, and beyond that, health care and educational opportunities and cultural activities. The women who held up the sign Bread and Roses were saying that they weren't content with improvements just in the bare necessities of life and work. They wanted opportunities to enjoy their lives and their families, to find beauty in the world, and to be treated with dignity and respect. Their demands were met over the years in that New England factory town as Lawrence opened up a series of free libraries, art galleries, concert halls, parks. For these women, as for most workers who are given the time and opportunity to talk freely about what they want for themselves, work should be a source of pride and joy and fulfillment. Not all of the time, but more of the time than it is. Not just working to live, but in some ways, for all workers, living to work, alive to our work. More than 30 years ago, radio commentator Stubbs Terkel created what I think was a micro industry in publishing oral histories of men and women in their jobs. And in his most famous collection, Working, a collection of people talking about what they do all day and how they feel about what they do, he observed that Americans go and get up and go to work each day as much for daily meaning as for daily bread, that they're as likely to describe how little their work fed their spirits as to complain about how little they were paid. Now, not that that means that a higher minimum wage and, more important, a fair living wage isn't crucial. It's just plain wrong. It's a violation of the golden rules of every living faith tradition that even after working 2 to 3 jobs, you can still not earn enough money to make ends meet or provide the basic subsistence needs of the bread of life. Today's federal minimum wage is how much do you think? $7.25 an hour, which has become a poverty wage instead of an anti-poverty wage, which is inhumane and soul-stripping. So here's the good news for Alabama. You pay the federal minimum wage. I live one state over in Georgia that still doesn't pay the federal minimum wage. The recommended minimal living wage is how much do you know now? $15 an hour. $7.25 to $15 an hour. That's a huge gap. Huge gap. It was my privilege to lead personal growth and spirituality groups for women in transition out of homelessness for more than a decade. Several hundreds of them, mostly women of color. Many of them arrived at shelters with little more than the clothes on their back. They came fleeing battering. They came because their husbands were incarcerated. They came because of debts and foreclosures, resulting in part from bad choices they had made, but in larger part from predatory lenders, from aggressive creditors, low wages and jobs they showed up for every day, despite huge logistic obstacles. No cars, no child care. So we first offered them bread. Literally, we first offered them bread, often the day-old leftovers from local fancy bakeries, the bagels and the croissants. And we offered them beds and the hugely important gift of safety. We expected them in return to be accountable, to have work, to learn to manage and save their money, God knows how, to save their money, while we provided their shelter and some necessities. Yes, they wanted to earn more and earn fairly, not just a minimum wage, but a living wage. Why not? We had the means to make it so. If they came to trust me, they sometimes shared their more hidden longings. Yes, they did crave satellite dishes and big screen televisions and fancy houses, larger than I have ever owned. Why not? That's what they were promised 24/7 in every corner of the media. But more than that, and much deeper than that, and with more urgency than that, they wanted, oh, they wanted roses. They wanted roses. They wanted worth and dignity. They wanted the chance to express themselves through their work. They wanted the chance to make a difference in their working lives. They wanted some beauty. They wanted some song. Work, the Persian poet Gilran wrote, is love made visible. Sister Joan Tisteter, a social activist and a Benedictine nun, tells us that the meaning of work is clear. Work, she says, involves all of us in the exercise of world building, all of us in the exercise of world building, of co-creation, and we must, each of us in each age, work in new ways to achieve this with bread.